1983. 1 year ago tonight, as we usually begin our program by updating the news, there were several items in the news. One, Roberta Calvi's widow was accusing the Vatican of working with the Opus Dei. That's that very conservative business organization that controls the major wealth of most of the Catholics around the world. And it's a secret society and a somewhat dangerous society. And she accused the Opus Dei of taking over the Vatican debts. They had a $1.2 billion missing money. That's several hundred million. And the worst part was the dummy fronts down in Panama and not explaining where it was going, and then later linked to organized crime and gun running and so forth out of Milan. Well, she accused the Opus Dei of taking over the Vatican debts, and she said the Pope shouldn't be involved as a money changer, and you should remove the money changers from the temple. And just this last week, there was an article about Roberta Calvi's widow. This was sent to me by Ted Rubenstein from the Chicago Tribune. It's November 30th, 1983. Scandal figure flees for life, from Reuters. The widow of Italian banker Roberta Calvi has fled to Britain in fear of her life after giving Italian magistrates new evidence implicating the Vatican officials in her husband's death. I think the Vatican was implicated in the Pope before this one and some other deaths too. She says the Vatican is implicated in, specifically in her husband's death, and she gave them information. The newspaper quoted Clara Calvi as saying the evidence proved her husband, who was known as God's banker for his links with the Vatican, was murdered to keep him quiet. He was murdered in London, and she's fleeing to London. I don't know why she thinks that's safe. The article says a 62-year-old head of Banco Ambrosiano in Milan, that's in the same building where the drug running and narcotics headquarters were, with siphoning these various guns and weapons around the world and drugs. Her husband was found hanging in Great Britain. That was in June 1982. At first they said it was a suicide. Then they had a second inquest and called his death a mystery. The new evidence implicates senior Vatican officials, Italian politicians, and leading members of the P2 Freemason Society. That's Licio Gelli and Ronald Reagan's friend, who was in his inauguration, who's now hiding in Argentina. She said, my life is in danger. That's why she's come to England. She's not safe in Italy anymore. She came across the documents while checking her late husband's effects in a strong box that was kept in the Bahamas. The information is very important, explosive, I think. So Mrs. Calvi, 1 year later, is saying the Vatican had a role in killing her husband, and she's talking about it. I talked about the story of the Tylenol murders. It was about to break. A Chicago stockbroker, who's still not named publicly, a dummy front in Chicago, an import-export business, and Mr. Lewis, a tax consultant. There's somebody in Chicago very high up and well-known who's involved with the Tylenol murders and the Tylenol scandals, which I believe and know is an international thing, going to Southeast Asia and India with Mr. Lewis's offices. He's been charged with writing an extortion note, but he hasn't been charged with any of the murders, even though he was once charged with murdering a friend of the family, and he got off of that one. That's still wide open and hasn't been solved. Colin Chapman had just been murdered, 54 years old, the designer of racing cars, died in England, founder of the Lotus Car Company. He was part of the development of DeLorean cars. Right after John DeLorean was arrested, Colin Chapman died, and they were involved with the Panamanian company, the funds paid by Panama from the Panamanian banks into Swiss banks. And with Mr. Chapman dead, Colin Chapman dead, they've been looking for a year for the money that went from Panama into the Swiss banks that he helped John DeLorean with designing the car. He was killed, and a whole year later, there's still a mystery there. And I'm sure that the reason he had to die was because he would know the answers to some of those questions they're not ready for. Also, the anti-terrorism plan for the LA Olympics, the big discussion of the Delta Blue Light team, is poised in readiness, sent from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, with Mr. Colonel Charles Beckwith in charge. He's the fellow that made such a disaster out of the Iranian crisis. And there was an article of Mr. Beckwith in the paper just this last Sunday, yesterday, saying that his suggestion for hostages to kill them all, that he'd shoot them on the spot and kill them all. That's the way he would do it if they have a hostage crisis at the Olympics in Los Angeles. If they want money, give an airplane, and when it goes up, blow them up. Well, the CIA and the Los Angeles Police Department and the COINTELPRO program and the Defense Department could have a coup whereby we lose all our freedoms, and they can kill the hostage on the spot that caused the martial law, and then kill him, and then we won't ever know the true story of how we are losing our freedoms. The same way that you killed, hired Jack Ruby, a few days or a week ahead, and he's to have a contract to kill somebody on a certain day, like Sunday, and then he panics when he realizes it's part of the Kennedy assassination. The story of killing them on the spot is very treacherous. Ed Davis, when he was chief of police, he's now a senator in California, wanted a guillotine, or Evel Younger wanted a gallows with a rope hanging, not a guillotine, the rope, at the airport. If there's a hijacker, you hang him right on the spot. Well, the hijacking brought a series of searches and invasions of privacy. Suspect that we're going to take planes off in every airport so that you can't get to a plane without going through this all of the time and being held up and going through bags. And a good percentage of the hostages were provocateurs at the time, but it brought the new laws so that there's a stumbling block to your freedom everywhere you go along the line. Also last year, the Belarus Secret came out by John Loftus, and I talked about it at length. That is one of the best books of the year, along with Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham. And in there he talks about Frank Wiesner of the OSS, who was director of the Office of Policy Coordination, who brought in the Nazis from the Iron Guard and the Romanians and so forth. And I learned just this year that Mr. Liebler, Wesley Liebler, who was an attorney for the Warren Commission, worked in the law office of Frank Wiesner in New York City, and Liebler was in charge of the testimony of the white Russian czarist, the friends of Lee and Marina Oswald in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. That was his expertise, and he came out of the law office of Frank Wiesner. I think Peter Del Scott has this book in his book on the Kennedy assassination. And he also tells in the book how General Patton was sheltering a large number of the SS members with him. That was also Fritz Kramer was on that staff, and Otto Skorzeny and their special units that were to be used later. Now, there's more on these Nazis that assembled together that came out in the London Times this last week and also yesterday, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But a year ago, these items were in the news, how the special forces I talked about was formed by Hitler's agents, Dr. Franz Alfred Seix, and how our Green Berets and our Mr. Beckwith got their muscles from Hitler's Nazis and from Otto Skorzeny, who formed those special forces. And now they want to come in quotes, to save us. They will create the situation, then they'll come in and save us. The excuse for killing the terrorists on spot, Beckwith said this week, has to do with, look at what happened at the Munich Olympic Games in 1972 with the hooded Palestinian terrorists and the 11 Israeli Olympic athletes that were killed. Well, it's been a few years since 1972, 11 years, and everyone involved with there, George Habash from Lebanon, with his links to Larry McDonald, the CIA, the links to Richard Nixon, the CIA was heavily involved with the Nazis and the Palestinians that created the crisis. And he says in his article that since that horror, we've watched and worried about the Olympics coming to Los Angeles, and he tells how in Munich, the Germans couldn't act. They could see the counter-terrorists through their scope, but they didn't shoot them. They had their sights ready, but they lacked the resolve, and they didn't fire. And you could watch on television for the first time this hostage rescue team, this wonderful phenomena. Well, that was duplicated 2 years later by the Los Angeles Police Department and the SWAT team. If you like to see that kind of action, then follow it up, because what you get is the first story, and what follows later is the actual terrible story of how the CIA and the Nazis, Otto Skorzeny and Hitler's Nazis in Palestine and in Atlanta, Georgia, and in Washington, set up the controversy, then have the excuse to save you from the problem. Now, at first, I was going to do the entire broadcast tonight on the new information on Hitler's diaries that was in the Sunday London Times on December the 11th. I did broadcast on that three broadcast last May and left it wide open. I felt that the continuity of the top Nazis who appeared in the story of the Hitler's Diary was so important. So yesterday I spent about 12 hours outlining that and decided next week I would probably do the entire hour on it. The article was written by a woman, Gita Sereni, and she went to visit East Germany, United States, and spent the past 7 months looking up and meeting the people involved in this story. But just to tell you how tangled it is, the first Nazi story on the Nazi Diary not only brought together Mr. Gert Heidemann, the fellow who had Goering's yacht, where he entertained Mr. Wilhelm Mohnke, M-O-H-N-K-E, the head of the Death's Head, the special group that provided a continuity of the Waffen-SS after the war for Adolf Hitler. He had Mr. Karl Wolff, who I wrote about in the Rebel article, and we'll do more about that, and he's friends with Wolff, and Wolff went down with Mr. Heidemann down to South America, and they saw Walter Rauf, and they were to see Mr. Bormann, Martin Bormann. And this news story has a more complicated interpretation. A man is in jail by the name of Mr. Cujau. His other name, Conrad Cujau, K-O-J-A-U. And he says that he wrote the diaries. He's in the jail because he wrote the diaries, but 3 years before he said he wrote them, they were in the United States in the hands of other people. And he's lying, but he's willing to stay there, and he won't tell who really did it. Now, the diaries were thrown out as not being real. About 20 were examined out of 60 diaries because the paper was used and manufactured in the 50s, the ink and paper. And they said, therefore, the diaries, even though they were authenticated by the Germans and top people like you, Trevor Roper, of British intelligence, as being real, the catch line was they can't be real because the paper and ink came later. They could be real if Hitler were alive, and there's a lot of unanswered questions. This article, the wave that we're getting on Hitler's diary, brings in his driver, Erich Kempka, K-E-M-P-K-A, who's the head of an organization called HIAG, so it sounds like Alexander Haig, and he was a member of the Waffen-SS, the elite group to protect Adolf Hitler. Hitler's driver is involved in this story, and he's funded with money from a businessman living in the area in Europe who gives money to the organization who wants to buy the yacht and allegedly brings Heidemann in for that purpose. Hitler's pilot, Jan Brouwer, is involved in this story. He meets with the SS. Currently, there is a birthday party for him, J-A-N-S-B-R-A-U-E-R. Wilhelm Mohnke, Hitler's chief of the SS, works and is socializes with the Hague, that same organization of the Waffen-SS now, and with Karl Wolff and Mr. Heidemann. He's in here, and also Karl Wolff written up in Operation Sunrise and the story of the meeting of minds of Alan Dulles and Wolff, who was the liaison of Himmler to the Americans and was in charge of Treblinka and the concentration camps. He was killing masses while he was meeting with Americans in Switzerland. Walter Rauf lives in Chile, and Wolff and Heidemann went down to see him. Martin Bormann is down in South America, although in this London Times they say that he was in Spain and wanted to see Mr. Heidemann, that he was in Spain. There's another man, Wolfgang Schulze, S-C-H-U-L-Z-E, from Stuttgart, an attorney living in Florida. And Otto Skorzeny, of course, was a kingpin who traveled around meeting the Waffen-SS. There's another man, his name is Mr. Klapper, K-L-A-P-P-E-R, one of the highest Nazis of the SS, who is head of the Liebstandarte, L-I-E-B-S-T-A-N-D-A-R-T-E. Lieb, L-I-E-B, stand, S-T-A-N-D-A-R-D-T. And that's part of that Haig group to maintain the Waffen-SS for 1,000 years. He's part of this, and a Fritz Stiefel, who's funding Kempka, Hitler's driver. And then another dangerous man, Jacob Tiefenthaler, who's part of the whole group, Tiefenthaler, T-I-E-F-E-N-T-H-A-L-R. And he has extensive contacts with former Nazis, and keeps his membership up in this organization, this Haig, H-I-A-G, again, it's not the H-I-G, working with Hitler's driver, with Hitler's pilot, but he also is in the United States Army in Germany working as chief of audiovisual instruction. Now, the only one missing out of this gang who worked at the Battle of the Bulge and worked terminating the war and with on Patton's staff was Fritz Kramer. Now, can you believe that Hitler's driver, Mr. Kempke, Hitler's yacht is in Florida, Hitler's pilot's involved, the head of the Death's Head Monkey who was at the Battle of the Bulge in the battle with Fritz Kramer and then ends to close up the bunker for Hitler, Carl Wolf, Mr. Ralph, they're all together. Martin Bormann, Wolfgang Schultz, Otto Skorzeny went on to work for the CIA and Galen at the same time. Klaus Barbie, they visited down in South America. Mr. Mengeles, Joseph Mengeles is in Paraguay. Mr. Clapper of the Liebenstadt, Fritz Stiefel funding the Haig organization and wanting to buy the Goering yacht. And Jacob Tiefenthaler to tap it off, who is employed, funding the group, working with them, employed chief of audio visual of the U.S. Army. That's quite a team, and it will take me 1 hour to break that down. I spent 10 hours outlining that article. So I think that we'll do more on that the entire week next week or maybe this week after. One piece of good news before we go on to some of the other news that I think is unsettling. There was an election in Japan, and Mr. Nakasone didn't do very well. There was a setback, so maybe the voting machines aren't all rigged after all. Now, I thought that one of the 36 motives for the 007 going down was the hoping that the anti-Soviet feeling would promote Mr. Nakasone just at the time of his election that was coming up, because he wants more arms, more weapons for Japan. Japan doesn't want to spend the money we want them to put in. They don't want to arm to the hilt. There has to be a reason so they could say, well, look at the vicious Russians. We have to arm, and here's Nakasone. He wouldn't appease it, sort of like the Ronald Reagan of Japan. And Nakasone was a Harvard student under Henry Kissinger. He's part of the Kissinger-Harvard crowd, and the president made this wonderful trip to see Nakasone to help campaign for him just prior to the elections, the aura of America. Maybe they think America's messed up and they don't want any part of it. Maybe at this point they voted against him because Reagan was there. Maybe Reagan thought he was funny. But as soon as the Korean airline went down, it escalated his star. And remember, it was the Japanese I quoted last week on the air who said that they traced the exact moment and hour that the plane dropped, but they didn't warn them that they were out of their area by several hundred miles. They just amazingly had contact with them, but couldn't remember or hear or warn them that their radar was off, three of the best pilots. So Japan and the United States intelligence had a role in letting this plane go into the wild wind and into the ocean. And it was used quite a bit for Japan at the time the plane went down, and tapping it off with the president going there just prior to the election. Well, in Spain, when they elected the new head of the government, this was almost a year ago, the Pope was going there to visit and campaign for his opponent, and they were taking down the political posters and things, so it would be nice for the right wing, the very conservative group, to see the Pope coming in with the aura of the church because they're all Catholic. Well, it didn't wash there, and they didn't vote. They said the Pope can't come till after the elections, and that's the way the president should be. He should stay away. And maybe his trip was in vain, and that's okay. Next week also, I'm going to update an article, an interesting article from the Washington Post on Western goals and Larry McDonald, and it's called Death Unsettles the Board of the Anti-Communist Unit. And the reason I bring it up now, just to touch on it, tell you it's out there, is that I mentioned last week how Mr. Lefevre, Ernest Lefevre, had a eulogy for Larry McDonald in the D.C. Times, Reverend Moon's paper, about 12 hours after the plane went down, that was so complicated and so anti-communist that I put it on the air. And I said that Lefevre is on the board of the organization that for strategic trade with Daniel Graham and General, the retired Fritz Kramer. Our American one isn't supposed to be a general. The Nazi is. But Fritz Kramer and Daniel Graham have their offices in Washington, and Lefevre is on the board. And Daniel Graham works directly with And they were with Admiral Moore and with John Reese of Western Goals. And if anybody wanted to unload Larry McDonald and blame the communists and have a power takeover of the computers, and also because of the scandal with the Los Angeles Police Department, I said last week and hinted that they would have foreknowledge. Somebody had foreknowledge. So now there's a vicious fight between a retired General Lewis Walt of Orlando, Florida, who commanded the Marines in Vietnam, and the military. There's a faction here fighting each other, which indicates it was not all peach and roses, and they could have dumped Larry into the ocean and taken over the monster or the control that was in the hands of the Birch Society and escalated even farther right and erased the chance of exposing the scandals in Los Angeles. There's an article in the paper just today, Global Problems Seem to Spur Draft Sign-Up, and it says, the shooting of the Korean airliner by the Soviet Union, the bombing of the Marines in Lebanon, and the invasion of Grenada have coincided with a sharp increase in draft registration. Now, I tried to make the point last week, and it's very important, that these are provocateur operations, and that we create the situation that we say, now join the army, because look at all the enemies. The Lebanese bomb us. We had plenty of warning. We knew it. They had newer warned of the security. The Grenada story we cooked up, it took us from 1979 to 1983. To make it safe for the Mafia and Robert Vesco again. But synchronizing them together, and that's why I stressed the point last week, the bunching of them together, the 007, the Burma explosions, the Lebanon and the Grenada, oh boy, the 17, 18-year-olds will think their country's falling apart and barricades in Washington. So the article says because of the 007, the Lebanon, and the Grenada, and that's exactly the effect they want. Come sign up and defend your country. And we'll watch some more coffins come home with flags, and these fools run off and don't even question the other news that indicates that all of these things were provocations that were well planned. Now, there's one short thing I want to mention. It's an article in the Dallas Times-Herald by Molly Ivins, I-V-I-N-S, about Charles Spears. And I hate the word theorist. She says, not your average conspiracy theorist. And she says that she's on Charlie's mailing list. And he transcribes these tapes and sends them to various people around the country and news media people. And she said one wonderful thing about Charlie Spears is that he believes in a whole lot of conspiracies. He's not just stuck on the Trilateral Commission or the Council of Foreign Relations. Now, it's like that interview that was done with me with the San Jose Mercury. And I hate these interviews or the ones in Playboy that Mordecai Richler. She takes a very serious subject, and Charles Spears can show you all the documentation to prove what he says is happening, and we share information, and we work very hard to try to turn this country straight. Then these snotty little writers come along and think they're so cute, and she says, what I don't have to do, I don't have to rely on the National Enquirer. He talks about his theories of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, the Odessa, and so forth, the National Security Council, the CIA. Well, there's nothing wrong with talking about those things. That's exactly what's coming down. And if she had any guts, she would examine it seriously, take one issue, and if she finds it wrong, then throw out everything else if she wants, but give us one or two wrongs. But these people don't have the nerve to do it. She'll talk about, she made fun of other opinions he had, suggesting murders of Natalie Wood or William Holden or the SS boys or laughing at Argentina or Mary Jo Kopechne and Chappaquiddick and William Buckley. All of these people are involved up to their earballs, if not down to their butts. And she, tongue-in-cheek, throws around the name of Alan Dulles and Galen Plans and the Buckley family and Herbert Hoover. Well, there is a connecting link. Time, place, city, bank. It all comes together very nicely, so consistently that she has no right to laugh at him, and she'll make fun of it. It's not an when somebody calls you Mae Brussels the theorist, I say goodbye, because a conspiracy is two or more people doing an illegal act. And when they call you a theorist, just say up yours, goodbye, because there's no time for these negative feelings. And she wants to put down what he's doing, and his intelligence, and his dedication, and his interest in not having World War III. Now, this particular lady can just open her paper and see that Ronald Reagan is ready for Armageddon. If it comes, I'll lead you. Well, what is that? That's not even a war. That's just suicide. And it's like Jonestown. He's getting us ready. He'll lead us to it. So if you want to write to her and tell her that you don't appreciate that, if you have a pen, Dallas Times Herald, Molly Ivens, I-V-E-N-S, here's the address, 1101 Pacific, Dallas, Texas, zip code 75202. And he you might send a letter out. Charlotte Spear suggested tell her your opinion of the profitless stand, how little he's made off of the subversion. The people that are part of these conspiracies have made a fortune. And the others, you know, just carry on, carry their own, and carry the burden of the lazy people or the people that just refuse to really study the papers every day. And if they don't become believers by next year, then they never had the mentality to believe it anyway, because next year isn't going to be like this year, and this year, last year, isn't anything like this year. Now, there was an obituary in the newspaper, the San Jose Mercury. I take a lot of papers, and this goes to the Larry Flynt story. David Emery called me, said, look at your San Jose Mercury. Mitchell Werbel III, soldier of fortune, died. If any of you have my broadcast of the last 3 or 4 weeks, particularly broadcast 624, where I said, how would you like to have these people for dinner? I talked about house guests that moved in on Larry Flynt, Gordon Novell and Mitchell Werbel, and gave you a little biography of those men. Now, Mitchell Werbel, the news story came out of Powder Springs, Georgia. Sure, he was old. Sure, he drank a lot. They described him as a soldier of fortune, a former international arms dealer, one-time operator of a counter-terrorist training school. Well, his son still operates it. It's still going. He's like Sven Kramer. The apple falls right next to that tree. Werbel's anti-communist activity over the years was linked frequently with the CIA. You better believe it. The silencers and the wiping out of individuals and entire nations. I mean, what chance did Larry Flynt have when you have this kind of guest around you? He served as an agent from the U.S. Office of Strategic Services, OSS, and of course he worked with the entire Gehlen Nazi operation. The World War II forerunner of the CIA. He was in the OSS, he was in the CIA. Most recently, Werbel was a security advisor for Hustler's manager, magazine publisher, Larry Flynt. Larry Flynt ended up in a federal hospital, called crazy. He's not crazy. He's been given some drugs that have altered his personality. He wasn't doing these things before Werbel moved in the house, but Werbel is dead. I was talking about him for, first I was talking about Larry Flynt, and all of a sudden his bad luck, because he's telling the truth, gets him in trouble. Werbel was a drunk. He had a cancer that was in remission. He's a no-good bum, but he still was a wheeler and dealer. And I asked the question, was his last grand act to deliver Larry Flynt to Uncle Sam? Because he was the one who was with Larry Flynt, dressed in a flag, instead of saying, don't do it. I mean, this is the great anti-communist I talked about. Puts a purple heart on Larry, and Larry gets a federal rap for it, and can't leave or go anywhere and enjoy his own home or his own physical therapy or dietitian. And Werbel goes with him to court, and he got, a $6,000 fine for having his cane or his stick that has a weapon in it. So he's dead. Forget that fine. Doesn't matter anyway. The main thing is that Larry Flynt has to live with all the charges and all the handling. But interesting thing, this violent anti-communist CIA, OSS, moving in when a man is going to become politically radical and write about Larry McDonald and write about the Nazis and the Kennedy assassination. In fact, there are many people that I've talked about on the air continuously that Mitchell Werbel worked with. One of the programs I did back in 1980, that was 3 years ago, broadcast 441, which some of you might want to get this one if you've become current subscribers. It's about the Kennedy assassination and Curtis Laverne Crawford, who was suggested by the Warren Commission members, one of them of the staff, of being Oswald's double. And the relationship, he worked in a circus where Jack Ruby picked him up, and he worked in the circus in Dallas. Ruby was visiting different people. I think there were handbills he was passing out or accumulating. And I talked about the Internation Circus that comes out of Chicago, Illinois. And the role of Frank Sturgis, his name was on the stationery, and G. Gordon Liddy was mentioned. He's on a friend of Larry Flynt's that moved in. His picture's in the February Hustler. Mitchell Werbel working for that operation. Well, Frank Sturgis is close to Jack Anderson. He's always had a close liaison with Jack Anderson. And Gordon Novell was going between Jack Anderson, John DeLorean, and getting Larry Flynt in trouble in California. And he had no brakes. He let these people in, and that's the Flynt Gate. The locks and doors and the walkie-talkies, the Flynt Gate opened, and in they rushed, and I did a program, and the man who warned us, he sent me a letter, and Charles Spears a letter about Internation Circus. I never followed it up for you. He was murdered shortly after he warned us about this group and the use of the circus for the Defense Department Intelligence Agency. There was another snide remark about Larry Flynt, an interview in the Chicago Tribune. Larry Flynt still hustling publicity and conspiracies, but and it tells about his home, his armed fortress behind an iron fence, and the bodyguards everywhere, an army of them on the lawn, in the driveways, tending the cars, limousines, and vans. They're dressed like Secret Service. They tell you this is the story of the security of Larry Flynt. And with that, all these people, these nice people, moved in. So with those kind of friends, you don't need any security. You could let everyone go if you're going to let those people move in. There's no security in that kind of a place, and he made a lot of mistakes, and he was excited and publishing this stuff, and the doors opened up and they came in. Well, Mitchell Werbel is dead, and that's a shame.